The Christmas season carries with it an air of expectancy. There are packages to be opened, carols and callers, sleigh bells and mistletoe, and all the wonderful traditions that go to make the holiday the exciting occasion it is. In fact, on such a festive occasion, you'd hardly expect to find a man with an attitude like this.
If I had my will, every idiot who goes about with Merry Christmas on his lips should be boiled with his own pudding and buried with a stake of holly through his heart.
However, that's Scrooge. You've met him before, no doubt, in Dickens' famous Christmas story. You'll meet him again in just a moment as Paul Landis of the University of Illinois' Department of English retells this heartwarming account of the events that occurred during a Christmas season in England. Now, Professor Paul Landis, as he's recorded A Christmas Carol by Charles Dickens.
Marley was dead, to begin with. There's no doubt whatever about that. The register of his burial was signed by the clergyman, the clerk, the undertaker, and the chief mourner. Scrooge signed it. And Scrooge's name was good upon change for anything he chose to put his hand to. Old Marley was as dead as a doornail. Scrooge knew he was dead? Of course he did. How could it be otherwise? Scrooge and he were partners for I don't know how many years. Scrooge was his sole executor, his sole administrator, his sole assign, his sole residuary legatee, his sole friend, his sole mourner. Scrooge never painted out old Marley's name, however. There it stood years afterwards above the warehouse door, Scrooge and Marley. The firm was known as Scrooge and Marley. Sometimes people new to the business called Scrooge, Scrooge. Sometimes Marley. He answered to both names. It was all the same to him. Oh, but he was a tight-fisted hand at the grindstone, was Scrooge. A squeezing, wrenching, grasping, scraping, clutching, covetous old sinner. External heat and cold had little influence on him. No warmth could warm him. No cold could chill him. No wind that blew was bitterer than he. No falling snow was more intent upon its purpose. No pelting rain less open to entreaty. Foul weather didn't know where to have at him. The heaviest rain and snow and hail and sleet could boast of the advantage over him in only one respect. They often came down handsomely. Scrooge never did. Once upon a time, of all the good days in the year upon Christmas Eve, old Scrooge sat busy in his counting house. It was a cold, bleak, biting, foggy evening, and the city clocks had only just gone three, but it was quite dark already. The door of Scrooge's counting house was open, that he might keep his eye upon his clerk, who in a dismal little cell beyond, a sort of tank, was copying letters. Scrooge had a very small fire, but the clerk's fire was so very much smaller that it looked like one coal. But he couldn't replenish it, for Scrooge kept the coal box in his own room. And so surely as the clerk came in with the shovel, the master predicted that it would be necessary for them to part. Wherefore the clerk put on his white comforter and tried to warm himself at the candle. In which effort, not being a man of strong imagination, he failed. A Merry Christmas, Uncle. God save you, cried a cheerful voice. It was the voice of Scrooge's nephew, who came upon him so quickly that this was the first intimation Scrooge had of his approach. Bah! Said Scrooge. Humbug. Christmas a humbug, Uncle? You don't mean that, I'm sure. I do. Out upon Merry Christmas. What's Christmas time to you but a time for paying your bills without money? A time for finding yourself a year older and not an hour richer? A time for balancing your books and having every item in them through a round dozen of months presented dead against you. If I had my will, every idiot who goes about with Merry Christmas on his lips should be boiled with his own pudding and buried with a stake of holly through his heart. He should. Uncle, nephew, keep Christmas in your own way and let me keep it in mine. Keep it, but you don't keep it. Let me leave it alone, then. Much good may it do you. Much good has ever done you. There are many things from which I might have derived good, by which I have not profited, I dare say, Christmas among the rest. But I'm sure I've always thought of Christmas time when it has come around as a good time, a kind, forgiving, charitable, pleasant time. Therefore, Uncle, though it's never put a scrap of gold or silver in my pocket, I believe it has done me good and will do me good. And I say, God bless it. The clerk in the tank involuntarily applauded. Let me hear another sound from you. Good. And you'll keep your Christmas by losing your situation. You're quite a powerful speaker, sir. I wonder you don't go into Parliament. Don't be angry, Uncle. Come and dine with us tomorrow. Scrooge said he would see him. Yes, indeed he did. He went the whole length of the expression and said that he would see him in that extremity first. But why, said the nephew, why? Why did you get married? Because I fell in love. Because you fell in love. Growled Scrooge, as if that were the only one thing in the world more ridiculous than Merry Christmas. Good afternoon. Nay, Uncle, but you never came to see me before that happened. Why give it as a reason for not coming now? Good afternoon. I want nothing from you. I ask nothing of you. Why can't we be friends? Good afternoon. Sorry with all my heart to find you so resolute. Well, we've never had any quarrel to which I've been a party. But I've made the trial in homage to Christmas, and I'll keep my Christmas humor to the last. So a Merry Christmas, Uncle. Good afternoon. And a Happy New Year. Good afternoon. At length, the hour of shutting up the counting house arrived. With an ill will, Scrooge, dismounting from his stool, tacitly admitted the fact to the expectant clerk in the tank, who instantly snuffed his candle out and put on his hat. You'll want all day tomorrow, I suppose.
Quite convenient, sir.
It's not convenient and it's not fair. If I was to stop you half a crown for it, you'd think yourself mightily ill-used, I'll be bound.
Yes, sir.
And yet you don't think me ill-used when I pay a day's wages for no work?
It's only once a year, sir.
That's a poor excuse for picking a man's pocket every 25th of December. But I suppose you must have the whole day. Be here all the earlier next morning.
Clark promised he would. And Scrooge walked out with a growl.
Scrooge took his melancholy dinner in his usual melancholy tavern. And having read all the newspapers and beguiled the rest of the evening with his banker's book, went home to bed. He lived in chambers which had once belonged to his deceased partner. They were a gloomy suite of rooms in a lowering pile of building up a yard. The building was old enough now and dreary enough, for nobody lived in it but Scrooge, the other rooms being all let out for offices. Now, in fact, there was nothing at all particular about the knocker on the door of this house, except that it was very large. Also, that Scrooge had seen it night and morning during his whole residence in that place. Also, that Scrooge had as little of what is called fancy about him as any man in the City of London. And yet Scrooge, having his key in the lock of the door, saw in the knocker, without its undergoing any immediate process of change, not a knocker, but Marley's face. Marley's face, with a dismal light about it, like a bad lobster in a dark cellar.
was not angry or ferocious, but it looked as Scrooge as Marley used to look, with ghostly spectacles turned up upon its ghostly forehead. As Scrooge looked fixedly at this phenomenon, it was a knocker again. He said, "Poof, poof," and closed the door with a bang. The sound resounded through the house like thunder. Every room above and every cask in the wine merchant's cellars below appeared to have a separate peal of echoes of its own. Scrooge was not a man to be frightened by echoes. He fastened the door and walked across the hall and up the stairs. Slowly, too, trimming his candle as he went. Up Scrooge went, not caring a button for its being very dark. Darkness was deep. Scrooge lighted. But before he shut his heavy door, he walked through his rooms to see that all was right. He had just enough recollection of that face to desire to do that. Sitting room, bedroom, lumber room. All as they should be. Nobody under the table. Nobody under the sofa. Small fire in the grate. Spoon and basin ready, and a little saucepan of gruel. Scrooge had a cold in his head. Upon the hob. Nobody under the bed. Nobody in the closet. Nobody in his dressing gown, which was hanging up in a suspicious attitude against the wall. Lumber room as usual. Old fire guards, old shoes, two fish baskets, washing stand on three legs, and a poker. Quite satisfied, he closed his door and locked himself in. Double locked himself in, which was not his custom. Thus secured against surprise, he took off his cravat, put on his dressing gown and slippers and his nightcap, and sat down before the very low fire to take his gruel. As he threw his head back in the chair, his glance happened to rest upon a bell. A disused bell that hung in the room and communicated for some purpose now forgotten with a chamber in the highest story of the building. It was with great astonishment and with a strange, inexplicable dread that as he looked, he saw this bell begin to swing. Soon it rang out loudly, and so did every bell in the house. This was succeeded by a clanking noise deep down below, as if some person were dragging a heavy chain over the cask in the wine merchant's cellar. Then he heard the noise much louder on the floors below, then coming up the stairs, then coming straight towards his door. He came on, through the heavy door, and a specter passed into the room before his eyes. And upon its coming in, the dying flame leaped up as though it cried, "I know him! Marley's ghost!" Same face. The very same. Marley in his pigtail, usual waistcoat, tights and boots. His body was transparent, so that Scrooge, observing him and looking through his waistcoat, could see the two buttons on his coat behind. Scrooge had often heard it said that Marley had no bowels, but he'd never believed it until now. No, nor did he believe it even now. Though he looked the phantom through and through and saw it standing before him, though he felt the chilling influence of its death-cold eyes and noticed the very texture of the folded kerchief bound about its head and chin, he was still incredulous. "And now, what do you want of me?" Marley's voice, no doubt of it. "Who are you?" "Asked me who I was." "Who were you then?" "In life I was your partner, Jacob Marley." Can you sit down?"
"I can."
"Good then.
Scrooge asked the question because he didn't know whether a ghost or transparent might find himself in a condition to take a chair. But felt that in the event of its being impossible, it might involve the necessity of an embarrassing explanation. But the ghost sat down on the opposite side of the fireplace as if he were quite used to it. You don't believe in me?
I don't.
What evidence would you have of my reality beyond your senses?
I don't know.
Why do you doubt your senses?
Because a little thing affects them. Slight disorder of the stomach makes them cheap. You may be an undigested bit of beef. A blot of mustard, a crumb of cheese. A fragment of an underdone potato. There's more of gravy than of grave about you, whatever you are.